This is a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. Go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Good morning, Inez.
Good morning, Priya. How are you this morning?
I'm doing okay. It feels like everything is just accelerating.
Yes.
Yeah. And there is a lot going on. I mean, I just learned this morning about even more announcements in the Victorian cabinet reshuffle. Harriet Hsing is no longer the Minister for Housing. I think.
What?
So I guess, you know, lots happening. And it feels like there's so many spinning plates to keep an eye on with the federal budget coming up, the state budget coming up, and then the Victorian state elections as well. And being like, what do I pay attention to? Because there are so many things that need to change. Where do I put my energy? And also recognizing that, you know, it's reform can only get you so far.
Yes, absolutely. For me, speaking of spinning plates and magic tricks, mine was a less politically important update, but I'm still riding the high of Demi Adejoyibe's interview last week, where I also attended his show, which was incredible. But him saying that asking how Ocean's 11 is similar to putting up a comedy special was the perfect question, and it really related to his comedy special, and he was like, how the hell did you know this? So I can see the future, and I am riding this high for a really long time. And I was telling people, like, I often don't feel nervous when I'm doing things. It's always afterwards where I spiral. But I think that interview was the first time I was like, oh, is this what people feel like before scary stuff? So that was a new experience for me. But I felt really honored to do it, and a little bit silly, but a nice fun time.
I think you did a great job. And can we get your brief review of the show? How was the show?
The show was amazing. It was like a lot of songs and a robot as well. And yeah, lots of different tricks, I guess, throughout the show. But I just thought it was really funny and experimental and subversive, like we had said. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you had a great time. I am just checking again whether I have gotten this wrong. And it does seem that Minister Hsing is no longer the housing minister. But, you know, who knows? I could have this totally incorrect. I'll keep checking as the
is this the news that was today?
This was yesterday, I believe. So there's been a change to the sort of cabinet in general, and, you know, various people stepping down, including Danny Pearson. But Harriet Hsing has moved to the health portfolio, which has been vacated by Marianne Thomas. So, you know what? I'll just read a bit more about this, and then we'll update you as the show goes on.
Yes, how interesting.
Fascinating. Now, we have a big show for you today, as usual, and it is going to begin with a conversation with activist, community worker, and co-founder of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Pat Chiappolone, who's speaking with us about revelations this weekend's Age that the City of Melbourne's private security force, or community safety officers, have been encouraged to use force against people sleeping rough in the CBD as part of their training. Now, the Homeless Persons Union has started a petition to stop the CSO program, and we will be sharing information about it in our show notes. But also, you can look it up on change.org by searching City of Melbourne Stop the CSO program now. And then we're going to listen back to part of a conversation between Mia from 3CR's Earth Matters and Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira and Laniuk who are two staunch and inspiring warriors engaged in the defense of Larrakia country. So we'll play part of that interview about Larrakia country, forest clearing and military housing development, as well as local community opposition. And then we'll hear a brief update from Leliana of the Community Defence Marshalling System about the ongoing fight for justice by former Medisaram workers, including details of a rolling picket at Ansell's Richmond headquarters.
And then we are luckily joined by Nicole Bartholomews, who's the Chief Executive at CoHealth, who joins us to discuss their second consecutive Platinum Honour at the 2026 Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards. Now, she's been the Chief Executive at CoHealth since 2019, having served as a vital decision maker in a range of leadership roles in community health since 2006, stating social justice and health equity are the core principles of her decision making and key drivers of her advocacy priorities. Now, we discuss why CoHealth is so vital in the Victorian health sector. And lastly, we'll be joined by Simon Tran, Better Buses campaign spokesperson, who joined us to discuss the improving the bus broken bus network in the West. Simon is a young resident of the West who is also a software engineer, but spends his spare time advocating for transport justice in his community. Having lived in the West for over two decades, Simon knows the struggle of growing up with transport hardships and the hopes future generations can instead have that the transport they deserve, unlocking opportunities and freedoms amidst this month's Free Public Transport Month.
Amazing. And I will back end all of our announcements by saying, yes, confirmed Minister Harriet Shing has moved to head up a different portfolio, the new Minister for Health, Ambulance Services and Water. And instead, the Housing Minister will now be Nick Stakos. So he will be the Minister for Housing and Building and the Minister for the Suburban Rail Loop. So an interesting development, and we'll hope to keep you posted about what that means. But for now, stay tuned and we'll be back to you shortly with the news headlines.
Don't have $1 million and still want to have a good education for your kid? Tune into the Dogs program. We are the defenders of government schools. 12 p.m. on Saturdays here on 3CR. 855 and AM dial podcast, streaming live on 3cr.org.au and 3CR digital. We defend government schools because they need it.
These are the news headlines for Thursday, the 16th of April. As the war in Sudan enters its fourth year this week, local communities report new deaths in Darfur in recent days, amongst the 700 reported civilians killed by drone strikes since January. Humanitarian workers warn that drone attacks are intensifying, deepening what is already considered the world's largest humanitarian crisis, with millions of people experiencing severe hunger and displacement. Access to aid has worsened over the past week as the United States and Israeli war in Iran disrupts critical aid supply routes, driving up fuel and food costs.
In other news this week, Lebanon and Israel held talks in Washington, but a ceasefire was not on the agenda and Hezbollah was not involved, leaving Lebanese officials with little leverage in negotiations dominated by ongoing Israeli military aggression. The talks come as Israel, backed by the United States, continues a sustained assault on Lebanon that has killed more than 2,000 people in recent weeks.
Also in headlines, a lawyer for imprisoned Palestinian political figure Marwan Barghouti reports that Barghouti was assaulted three times by Israeli prison guards over the past month, describing a pattern of escalating abuse, including beatings and denial of medical treatment. The claims come amid reports of worsening conditions for Palestinians imprisoned by Israel, and family members and activists have reported that requests for visits from lawyers and independent observers have been denied. Coupled with the abuse inflicted on Palestinian prisoners, legal experts say that this constitutes violations of international law governing the protection of civilians and detainees during the conflict and the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Also in news this week, the state government fire agency is preparing to ignite a 34,000-hectare plant burn in the Snowy River National Park within days, despite most of the area already being severely affected by the Black Summer bushfires. A local collective in East Gippsland, the Goongarra Environment Centre, says fire ecologists and biodiversity researchers have urged the state government to halt the burn, warning it is not supported by science and could further endanger more than 110 threatened species.
In other news, the federal opposition has unveiled a new immigration policy that rights organisations are describing as divisive, discriminatory and lacking in humanity. The policy includes measures such as social media vetting for visitors, the introduction of temporary protection visas and reduced appeal rights for asylum seekers, alongside reassessing visas issued to more than 2,000 Palestinians. Experts warn the approach revives policies that previously left people in prolonged uncertainty and entrenched discrimination, saying it undermines Australia's government obligations under the United Nations Refugee Convention.
And when has that ever stopped this country? And finally, in headlines this week, industrial action at Marybeck Council is escalating as library staff join other workers in a widening pay dispute supported by the Australian Services Union. The union says the action, part of a broader campaign across 8 NARM councils involving 7,000 workers, comes after stalled negotiations, with workers seeking a 22% pay rise over 4 years to address real wage decline since 2021. Those taking industrial action say low wages are affecting the quality of council services and that many council workers are struggling amid costs of living pressures, let alone being able to live in the councils they work for. The Australian Services Union has called out the Allan Labor government for fast-tracking a pay increase for mayors and councillors of 20%, but leaving behind workers. These have been the news headlines for Thursday, the 16th of April, and now we are going to plug a couple of events that are coming up.
Yes, firstly, that is time sensitive, which is today at 16th of April outside of the Supreme Court at 8:45 to around 9:30. It's a gathering for Yoko. Now, we've reported on this a few times already, but it's outside of the Supreme Court, and the proceedings for Yoko's case has now concluded at the Melbourne Magistrates Court. The case will continue at the Supreme Court of Victoria until a jury trial, which is expected. So please come and wear red in Yoko's memory, and that is at 8:45 in the Supreme Court.
There is also a couple of events happening today. One we'll play a little CSA for. The other one is a film screening being held by Free Palestine Victoria. It's not today. It's tomorrow. It is Friday, the 17th of April at Cinema Nova, and it is basically going to be a screening of a documentary called Tomorrow's Freedom, which tells the story of Palestinian political leader Marwan Barghouti. And it's one of a number of events organized to mark Palestine Prisoners' Day. And there is also an upcoming Palestinian Prisoners' Day rally on the 19th of April at 12 p.m. outside the State Library in NARM. And finally, also wanted to plug an event that I'm involved in co-organizing with the Center Against Racial Profiling that is coming up next week, and that is called Young Black Missing. It's a conversation about race, missing persons, policing, and the courts in Australia with Dr. Amy McQuire and Martin Hodgson. It's going to be held online Thursday, the 23rd of April from 1 to 2 p.m. And you can find the ticket link in the bio of Center Against Racial Profiling on Instagram. Now, this is a fundraiser for the family of Imabale Manukariza, who tragically went missing and passed away in 2021. And his coronial inquest is upcoming. Families still don't know what the dates are, but we will need to bring family members over from Borloo, Perth, and, you know, with fuel costs increasing, the cost to bring people over, to fly people over so they can attend Imabale's coronial inquest in person is only going to rise. So if you can join, it would be much appreciated. And tickets are free for mob, Afro-diaspora, and families of missing persons. So again, head to @CenterAgainstRacialProfiling on Instagram and follow the link in our bio. You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:14 in the morning.
War or public housing? Resist the push to defund essential services. Increasing militarisation and drive to war around the world is taking public money away from essential government spending on things like public housing, education, aged care, childcare and health. On Thursday, 16th of April at 6 p.m, come and hear from speakers on how we can resist the push to become a weapons economy and instead fund essential public services. Blue Room, City of Melbourne's multicultural hub. For more information and to RSVP for your free ticket, please visit the Save Public Housing Collective on Facebook or Instagram. A 3CR supporter.
The Commons Social Change Library is an online collection of educational resources for those involved in community campaigns and social and labour movements. It collects, curates and distributes key lessons and resources from progressive movements from around Australia and across the globe. The library includes over 1,400 resources covering campaign strategy, community organising, activist history, digital campaigning, justice, equity, diversity and inclusion, and much, much more. It's free to access the library, so check out the collection at www.commonslibrary.org.
You tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And we are now joined by our first interviewee for today, activist, community worker, and co-founder of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria, Pat Chapalone, who is speaking with us about revelations in this past weekend's Age newspaper that the City of Melbourne's private security force, or so-called community safety officers, have been encouraged to use force against people sleeping rough in the CBD as part of their training. Now, the Homeless Persons Union has consistently been fighting against this controversial program, to say the very least. And they've started a petition now to stop the CSO program. You can find this on change.org by searching City of Melbourne Stop the CSO program now. But we'll also have the link in our show notes. Good morning, Pat.
Morning. We don't have to be so formal. You can call me Spy.
I'm like, I don't know. Should I call you Pat?
Yes.
I'm so glad that you said that, because I asked Kelly and I was like, is it Pat now? Do I say?
No.
Well, good morning, Spike.
Hi.
It's so good to have you back on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to start with these revelations in The Age by a former so-called community safety officer from the City of Melbourne that he'd been directed to use force against people sleeping rough. Now, I imagine that this news is not a total surprise to the Homeless Persons Union, but can you talk about what it's been like to receive that confirmation that CSOs have been officially encouraged to use force?
Just before I go on to that, just quick, in the intro you said something about the Crown Lance, so the private security firm that was employed to, well, initially the argument was to protect local law officers in doing their work. That ended earlier this year, and so these, what they're calling community safety officers, are actually employed by the City of Melbourne now.
Yes, you're right. That's an important correction.
No, so I don't mean to be, I just thought it's an important thing to say that from pressure from community, we were, they felt that pressure, and rather than have a private security firm, unfortunately, they continued with this, sort of blunt instrument. The state, the first thing it goes to is force when it wants to solve a problem, and they see people sleeping rough or homelessness, as a public order issue. And I guess when we first heard that this was happening, like the whole security thing was happening, we knew it was, as you've already said, we were like really, it was clear to us that something bad was going to happen, that their intention was to use, it was always going to be to use physical force to intimidate folks and physically remove them, if not, get into punch-ons with them. That's where this is going.
Mm-mm. Yeah, and I I'm glad that you did provide that clarification, because it's not just that public funds are being used to arrest like a private goon squad. It is now employees of the City of Melbourne that are tasked with this job. Now, what have you heard from rough sleepers in the CBD about the impact of these patrols since they were introduced at the end of October last year?
So, part of the Homeless Persons Union job. That's one of the really distressing part. I mean, apart from, having security people harassing and, intimidating people, but hearing the impact that it has on them. Life as a rough, or as an unhoused person, or as a rough sleep, is really tough. So you feel like you're not welcome in public space. People already experiencing trauma from the incidents leading up to them becoming homeless. Mm. So then having to deal with someone getting in their face, making them feel like they're not welcome, just adds insult to injury. Like it rubs salt into their wounds, makes them feel like they're not welcome. Some people have been bullied. We've heard stories of people being kicked, and being asked to sit in areas where the street cleaning machines were wetting them, and so like we've heard some horror stories, and it's that's been really I guess it's important to bear witness to what people go through, but that's been a really difficult part of the job.
Yeah, absolutely, and you know, to me, this does seem like there's been such a normalization of dehumanizing homeless people that, you know, for some people it might seem like, oh, a surprise that force is being used. But as you said, you know, there has been a very, very long process of, I guess, building a social license almost and pushing that boundary to see what these officers can get away with in terms of, you know, making people miserable when they're just trying to survive.
Kelly and I went on Saturday to go speak to some people to collect some, just to see how people were going based on the information we got Saturday morning about the revelations, and they're really resigned. It feels like the people that are out there day in, day out, you know, like they're really out of the way. They don't feel like they can inhabit public space proudly and openly when they should, because the city belongs to all of us. It just doesn't belong to the people who are shopping and people that own and the retailers. So they're pushed into alcoves and out of the way. And they really resigned and sort of conditioned, as you said, to the violence and intimidation. It's actually really sad. And it's something that we have to do a lot of work to get to build people up again. That's another part of this job. You know, at some stage, we have to be able to put pressure on local government, because they also have a responsibility for people who are experiencing homelessness to be able to enjoy the city. Yeah. You know, they pay taxes every time they buy something. You know, they pay, you know, GST every time they buy something, and they spend most of their money in the CBD. So they should be their rights should be respected, not just as consumers, but as human beings also. And so this is where the city of Melbourne, you know, we see Nick Reese sort of pumping up the arts and how Melbourne's a social, you know, a place to party and all this sort of stuff. But the social justice, the human rights aspects of the city of Melbourne and their responsibility to those two things has been really lacking. And it just shows there's a real deficit there, and it just shows that it's obvious he's not up to it, and the whole council isn't up to it if they're going to allow something like this to happen.
Yeah, it's so deeply classist the way that... Yeah. You know, this operates, and the idea that people should only be able to legitimately access public space and to be in these areas of the CBD when they can pay to play already tells you about the kind of society that, you know, these politicians want to create. Now, there have been similar developments in local governments policing rough sleeping in other areas, including the city of Maribyrnong and city of Port Phillip. What have you noticed about how these programs are marketed, and then how the broader public, like, you know, people who haven't had experiences of homelessness, are responding to them? Do you think people really understand how the patrols work?
That's a really good question. I think each area has its own specific characteristics. So, like, in speaking to the people from the Footscray community response, a lot of this was sparked off, like, their security program, because theirs was initially a private security also up until February, was a response to the killing of, I believe the man's name was Abdi Fatah Ahmed. Mm. In that public space, and there was like a bit of a like moral panic, because people would drink. He wasn't, but people were drinking in public in Footscray, and the public's it seems like retailers and I guess just average, I guess civilians, if for want of a better way of putting it, just, were sort of freak. They overreacted to what was happening, and so they asked for a response. And so it's been marketed as a way to de-escalate sort of conflicts on the street, as a way of connecting people up to services.
Mm.
As a way of dissolving encampments, for example, in the city of Port Phillip, that's what the big issue is there. They've actually changed their local laws to make it illegal to be asleep. My understanding is that they've actually changed their local laws because they were actually quite welcoming of people sleeping rough up until the start of the year. And so, yes, it's been marketed as a way to, but fundamentally to get people off the street and connect people up to services. But also what's made the city of Melbourne's approach much more sinister is it's constantly equating homelessness with a threat to public safety, with criminality, with mental health issues. So the pathologizing of homelessness, taking our eyes off the systemic failures and economic inequality that have led to these people's situation, and sort of laws, a crisis of common one accepting people if they're under the influence of drugs, if you don't have ID. There's so many barriers to being able to accept accommodation, even if you can access it.
Mm.
What they're highlighting is the sort of social disorder aspect that has no genuine connection with homelessness. This has got nothing to do with homelessness.
Yeah.
Does that answer your question? Yeah. Is that crazy?
No. That was really, really good because I think it talks about the kind of language that is being used to sell these programs actually completely does not match what they do on the ground. And, you know, The Age also reported that the city of Melbourne intends to double its CSO team from 11 to 22 officers, and it set aside a further $1.7 million in its draft budget for 2026-27. Now, how else could these resources be used to actually support people sleeping rough?
So, I guess from the Homeless Persons Union perspective, We really support a housing first, public housing approach. But until that happens, people that are homeless or unhoused need to be able to access showers, laundries, cooking facilities, places where they can hang out. Being able to produce their own newsletter, community development programs, peer workers, AOD workers, that's what we need, outreach workers, people that know people's names, people that can go out and say, "Good day, how you going today?" Like maybe a couple of nurses, without any sort of you don't have to, enlist on with a social worker or do an assessment if you don't like, but we need to make these fundamental services available to people. And I think it's the local government's responsibility to do that.
Mm.
As ratepayers, as people that live in the local government area, we believe it's their role to make sure that people are supported, right now there isn't the housing. I mean, there is, but it's not being made available to people that are homeless. There's plenty of empty private houses and even public properties.
Mm.
So the housing crisis. That's for another show. But yeah, we need to be able to services like outreach, lived experience workers, peer workers, AOD workers. Support workers need to scrap this security sort of this garbage, this intimidation, this hassling of folks, and let's support people that are doing it really hard.
Yeah, what you've said also just, I guess, relies on a fundamental change to how we approach other folks in our communities where we live who are doing it tough and, you know, actually centering dignity and recognizing the humanity of other people and saying, you know, if I am a ratepayer in a particular area, you know, I believe that my tax dollars should go towards supporting people who are in these challenging circumstances rather than saying, well, I don't want people here and I'd rather, you know, have a sanitized public environment that is enforced with violence, you know?
That's right.
So just to wrap up, Spike, how are the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria responding to the weekend's revelations and I guess this program more broadly? And yeah, can you tell us about that petition and how people can support your work?
So the petition is to continue to put pressure on the City of Melbourne to completely rescind and end this program completely. It has to end. So please sign the petition. I guess the other thing that you can do is to keep an eye on our socials for any other things that we're doing. Also, the City of Melbourne is accepting public submissions to their budget, which is double, as you said, which is spending another $1.7 million to double the security detail from, and that's the other thing. You have it's a quasi-security bloody military detail walking around town. So they're taking public written submissions up until April 28 on their budget, and they're taking. You can make an in-person submission to the local council meeting on May 2nd, I believe. So, look, please sign the petition. Stay with us. We really need... If we let this happen, this is on us.
Mm.
If we turn a blind eye to people that are really struggling, them in some cases being kicked, you know, being bullied and being treated like they're worthless and made to feel like they're not welcome in our city, that's on us.
Mm.
Because, like, quite honestly, I don't expect anything more from a local politician, to be honest with you. I really and I think it's on us to put pressure on them to force them to fess up to the human rights and social justice responsibilities. So please stay with us on this, because we're going to be really sort of dogged about this and not going to let this go.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for all of the work that you and the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria do. And we'll have links to the petition in our show notes and look forward to keeping this conversation going and keeping the pressure on. Thanks so much, Spike.
Thanks, Priya.
And that was Patrick Spike Chapalone, who is an activist, community worker, and co-founder of the Homeless Persons Union of Victoria. And he spoke with us about revelations in this weekend's Age that the City of Melbourne's security force or community safety officers have been encouraged to use force against people sleeping rough in the CBD as part of their training. And as Spike mentioned, the Homeless Persons Union has started a petition to stop the CSO program, which we will have in our show notes. And we will also include information there about how to make a submission on the City of Melbourne's budget for 2026-2027. It is 7:33 in the morning and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No, no, no. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And now we are going to listen back to part of a conversation between Mia from 3CR's Earth Matters program and Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira and Laniuk, who are two staunch and inspiring warriors engaged in the defense of Larrakia country. Now, Larakia country is Laniuk's country, and together with Te Raukura and an ever-expanding network of fellow protectors, she's been waging a staunch fight against military housing development on her land. So today we're going to play the first part of Mia's interview with Laniuk and Te Raukura, where they talk about Larakia country, forest clearing, and that housing development, as well as local community opposition. And you can listen to the full conversation at 3cr.org.au/Earth Matters and catch Earth Matters every Sunday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on 3CR 855 a.m.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. We have listeners from all over the continent, few of whom would have had the pleasure of visiting Larakia country. What can you share about this special place?
Oh, this is one of my favourite topics.
I'm sure.
I love Larakia country. That's my grandfather's country. It's the land that held me as I grew up as a child. It's always such a joy for me when someone says that they've been to Darwin or they've spent time or lived in Darwin, because it's Larakia country is so special. And look, all Indigenous people are biased. We're all going to say that our land's the most beautiful land in the world. You know,
we win.
It should be.
Yeah, absolutely. That's love.
Yeah. But, you know, Larakia country, it's big, thick monsoonal clouds. It's falling asleep to the sounds of frogs. It's maybe finding a green tree snake, you know, in your backyard. Like it's just constant beauty and surprise and power and softness. It's beautiful saltwater country. We've got the Tiwi Islands a little bit further above us, and we've got Timor just above that. And then, you know, it's just this beautiful intersection of worlds just softly sitting there, just waiting for people to come and be held by it.
Oh, I can hear the love coming through your words. Do you find it hard to be based down here on Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country then?
I do. Wurundjeri country is beautiful as well. I mean, I don't know if there's anywhere on this planet that we couldn't say is beautiful and powerful. There's just difference and diversity. It is hard being away from home for so many reasons. But then, you know, as is the complexity of colonization and surviving as Indigenous people, it can also be hard being home, you know, in these systems of violence, of colonial capitalism. Do any of us ever truly feel at peace, you know, as we have to survive in so many different ways and bring so many different versions of ourselves to survive? So I'm often, and I think like a lot of people, just holding the complexity of place and belonging and responsibility to place, to be a responsible visitor on Wurundjeri country and to be a responsible Larakia person and live into my spiritual responsibility to my land, and that no matter where I stand on this planet, I am responsible to Larakia country.
Te Raukura, did you want to share anything about your relationship to Larakia country, to Wurundjeri Woiwurrung country? Where do you fit into this constellation of places?
Yeah, thank you. My connection to Larakia country is through Laniuk, who is my partner, and she took me to Larakia country for the first time, and I was very blessed to meet her family and her lands. I would say that Larakia country has some of the best sunsets that I've ever seen in my entire life. Beautiful mangroves. And something that I am particularly excited by is that Larakia country is also home to dugongs. And from a very young age, I've been obsessed with manatees. And so dugongs are like the Southern Hemisphere cousin of the manatee. and you can find dugongs in the saltwater sea country that is shared between Larakia and Tiwi country. And so I've been lucky enough to go to both places, actually, and spend time with traditional owners in both places. And I feel, you know, I'm Māori and I'm constantly conscious of my obligations as an Indigenous person living and visiting upon other Indigenous people's lands, how to do that in a way that is decolonial and honourable. And that's hard when I'm here on a visa through colonial pathways. And so I started off in my connection to Larakia country basically volunteering for Laniuk's campaign for a day a week, because my background is in campaigning and community organising. And that day a week has turned into 7 days a week.
Well, yeah, no surprises there, which I suppose takes us a bit to, unfortunately, the threat that we're hearing about on Larakia country. Defence Housing Australia are attempting to clear about 132 hectares of old growth coastal bushland in an area of Larakia country known as Lee Point. in order to build about 800 houses for the military and their families. What impact would this project have if it goes ahead?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big question. And I do just want to clarify as well that the houses being built are partly for military personnel, but the majority of the housing is for private profit.
And private profit that funds the military.
Yes, mm-hmm. that goes back into the military.
Yeah, Defence Housing Australia are essentially tasked with making money for the military, and they do that through the acquisition of stolen Indigenous land and then the sale of that stolen Indigenous land to
acting as property developers. Yeah, yep. Exactly. Yeah, I see.
And it's so devastating to imagine the future that Defence Housing Australia is trying to take us down, where this like beautiful, lush, abundant coastal bushland, if we can just imagine like walking through the bush and then landing at the sand, like it's so special and beautiful. And I just like, it just makes me sick thinking about that becoming cement, generic copycat houses that just sort of like feeds into this inaccessible lifestyle that is reserved for a select few who can afford coastal homes. It just to me represents everything that Darwin isn't, everything that Ladakhia country isn't, and stands to take so much away from Ladakhia people, but from all people living in Darwin. It's such a biodiversity hotspot. We have migratory birds coming from all over the world, and like as far as Siberia. We have turtle hatching grounds. It plays a very important role in Ladakhia dreaming and creation stories. And so it's just so deeply devastating to see this miscalculation of value, that DHA can put a few figures on a piece of paper and say, this is the value of this destruction. And actually it's immeasurable what they will take away from Ladakhia people and from all people living in around Darwin. And I mean, I would go so far to say the world, when these areas are destroyed, it takes something away from everyone. And that is, it's so hard to calculate that because we're talking in terms of capital and we're talking in terms of money. But this is, I want to have this conversation about spirit. I want to have this conversation about interconnectedness. I want to have this conversation about the longevity of and future of our lands and our children. What are we leaving our children? And that was the thing that motivated me, motivated us. When I was sort of watching and hearing about what was happening at Lee Point, one of my sisters had just had a baby and we were sitting in this like celebratory joy. And I realized that the next generation is well and truly here. And as a Ladakhia person, my responsibility is here now. What am I giving the next generation? What do I have to give? And so I think that there are multitudes of motivation for me in protecting Lee Point, but my responsibility to be able to give something to the next generation, and that responsibility belongs to all of us. What are we leaving for the next generation?
I think I would also add that, like, at this stage in the climate crisis, we need to be keeping every old growth tree in the ground in the same way that we need to be keeping fossil fuels in the ground. Like, we are at a stage where environmental devastation is so severe through the processes of, you know, 200 years or so of colonization of these lands and my lands and all the other lands that colonization has impacted, that every single old growth forest and every single old growth tree needs to stay in the ground. And at Lee Point, there are trees that are older than the colony of Australia. There are trees that are 400 years old, and there are over 200 species of birds in what is actually quite a small area. I was chatting with Amanda Lilleman, who's a bird expert, a doctor, environmental scientist. She's one of the whistleblowers from Charles Darwin University who actually exposed the lies in the kind of environmental impact assessments that was being done to justify this housing project going ahead. And she was talking about how there's the same number of species of birds at Lee Point, which is reasonably small, as there is at Kakadu. Sorry, I always say it in a Māori way. Kakadu National Park, which is a very large area.
And off the top of my head, I think that's about 280. I used to be a tour guide in Kakadu.
Yeah,
actually.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, but she said it's very similar.
Wow.
And so it's a, when Ladio talks about it being a biodiversity hotspot, it, that's the, I guess, the facts and stats that sit behind that, that line.
Yeah, I mean, it's a travesty to hear about this incredible place being under threat. And it makes a lot of sense that there's been plenty of community opposition to the project. Can you tell us a little bit about what that opposition has looked like?
It's been around 5 years, I think, that people in the Darwin community have been resisting this project, this destruction, and successfully so, through like any means necessary. We've had Larrakia elders who have taken forward court cases to try to protect the cultural heritage, the ceremonial sites that sit within the area that is known as Binibara, to the Larrakia people. We've also had Friends of Lee Point and Save Lee Point and Binibara Camp, which is a range of local Darwin groups who care passionately about the biodiversity and bird life that exists there, that live there, that want this place to be protected now for future generations. And then a couple of years ago, Laniok and Shana and Cyan started the Return Lee Point to Larrakia People campaign, which essentially is calling for the protection of that land and the protection of those birds and that and the wildlife, but also to go one step further and right the original wrong, which is that that land was unlawfully stolen from Larrakia people. And if we want to heal that wound, we actually need to return that land to Larrakia people's ownership, protection and care. And so we've been doing that for about two and a half years.
Yeah, coming up to 3 years.
Yeah. And that has involved, you know, delivering a petition to Canberra that was tabled by Senator Lydia Thorpe, who is a blessing.
Bless that woman.
Yeah. and then to also delivering a petition to the Northern Territory Parliament via Justine Davis, who is an independent MLA who holds the seat for Johnston.
And another blessing.
Another blessing. Holding it down on really so many things that so many of us care about. And that led to a meeting with the Attorney General, Marie-Claire Boothby, who was actually quite warm towards us and open towards the idea of protecting that land. We went with a pitch that was basically like, we believe that this land should be a Larrakia-owned eco-sanctuary. We did a bunch of research on her and found that she's very interested in women and jobs and businesses and women
running their research.
Yes, yeah. And so we went in and we were like, there's going to be amazing businesses, there's going to be superfoods, bush foods, eco-sanctuary, jobs
women,
for every
women
Larrakia woman.
Women reclining on every surface. Living in luxury.
But she was actually quite open to the idea, and more or less what we asked her was, can you halt this destruction for long enough for us to get a feasibility study together about what an eco-sanctuary could do in terms of protecting this place, creating jobs, creating income, while also protecting culture and cultural heritage and sacred sites. And we have just been lucky enough to get the first grant towards that feasibility study secured.
Congratulations.
But unfortunately, the bulldozers are poised to come back as soon as wet season ends in Larrakia country, which is like next month. And so we are in a bit of a race against the clock with bulldozers. Yeah.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:48 in the morning, and we just listened back to the first part of Mia from Earth Matters' interview with Laniuk and Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira about Larrakia country, forest clearing and military housing development, as well as local community opposition to the destruction of Lee Point. And you can listen to the full conversation at 3cr.org.au/Earth Matters and catch Earth Matters every Sunday from 11 to 11:30 a.m. on 3CR 855 a.m. Now, just a quick weather check, if my Bureau of Meteorology app opens. So today in Narm, it looks like there's going to be showers developing across the day. It currently feels like 11.1 degrees and is sitting at 15.1 degrees Celsius. We're looking to a maximum of 25 degrees, and it's going to be sunny for at least until lunchtime. But then with showers starting from around 1 o'clock and increasing over the evening. So just something to be aware of. If you're leaving the house, heading out to work, you may need an umbrella on your way back. And we'll be back to you shortly with our next segment for today.
Women on the Line, a radical intersectional current affairs program.
Making space for the voices of women and gender diverse people.
Featuring in-depth conversations with guests from Socord Australia and beyond.
Ultimately, we're looking to care for country, to continue our culture, to continue our ceremonies, so that our children have a strong sense of self and belonging.
Just because our marginalization intersect where we're both disabled, it doesn't change your white privilege. It doesn't change your straight privilege. It doesn't change your able-bodied privilege.
Sex work, the word itself, has been such a word with a lot of stigma. However, we cannot ignore that there are women out there who are making their livelihood out of this job.
Listen every Monday morning at 8:30 on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM, or stream live on 3cr.org.au.
Love podcasts? We've got you. Find Women on the Line via the Community Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Women on the Line, where about?
Feminisms in their multitudes.
First Nations sovereignty.
Land back.
Trans liberation. Poo-poo on the turfs.
Abolition.
Anti-racism.
Sex worker rights.
South liberation.
Disability justice.
Anti-imperialism.
Decolonisation.
An end to borders.
Workers' justice.
And so much more.
Women on the Line, broadcasting on the 3CR airwaves since 1986.
Welcome back to 3CR Thursday Breakfast. And just a reminder that we plugged earlier in headlines, there is the gathering for Yoko today at 8:45 a.m. So in about 45 minutes, if you're in the city anyway, please pop in. So it's outside the Supreme Court of Victoria on William Street, 8:45. They'll set up and hang lanterns. And the proceedings for Yoko's case has now concluded at the Melbourne Magistrates Court. The case will continue at the Supreme Court of Victoria until a jury trial, which is expected in 2027. Please go and please wear red if you can for a very, very important cause. And once again, it is 8:45 today outside the Supreme Court of Victoria on William Street. And now we will play a brief update from Liliana of the Community Defence Marshalling System about the ongoing fight for justice by former Medisaram workers, including details of a rolling picket at Ansell's Richmond headquarters. We'll also share the full list of campaign demands.
Hi Priya, my name is Liliana. I'm a Level 4 Lead Marshal with CDMS and I've been helping to organise the monthly picket outside of Ansell's offices. Look, we're not here to sit on ceremony waiting for slave drivers and their friends to make a change of heart. We're picketing every month outside of Ansell's headquarters because what they've done is horrible. It's atrocious, it's disgusting. And it's in the interest of every worker to care about what's happening in their neighbouring countries, whether that's Sri Lanka, whether that's India, whether that's Malaysia, whether that's Bangladesh, or anywhere else in Southeast Asia. So we demand that Ansell, Medisaram and its friends repay all of the lost wages and compensate every single one of the workers. Ansell must actually have a real timeline and a real plan, and Ansell must give a written guarantee to permanently stop any sort of fraudulent activities with subcontractors such as Medisaram.
And that was Liliana sharing a brief update about the ongoing fight by Medisaram workers or former Medisaram workers who are part of Ansell's supply chain. And Ansell's headquarters are in Richmond, Victoria. And as Liliana mentioned, the Community Defence Marshalling System have been acting in solidarity with Medisaram workers, many of whom have been deported back to Bangladesh running a rolling monthly picket outside the Richmond headquarters. Now, I wanted to share a current list of demands that has been passed on by Liliana, made by Medisaram workers at the Melbourne picket on the 27th of March. Number one, all workers who have already returned to Bangladesh must be compensated quickly so that they can return to normal life as soon as possible. Number two, Ansell must announce and implement the specific date of compensation within 1 week. And number three, Ansell must give a written guarantee to permanently stop Medisaram's fraudulent activities. It is through their cooperation that Ansell and Medisaram have jointly tortured the workers. Number four, Ansell and Medisaram must jointly pay compensation for all harassment suffered by workers within 1 week. And finally, number five, Ansell must accept responsibility for violating the rights of the workers and be held accountable. Now, this is an incredibly harrowing story and staunch fight, and really encourage folks to go back and listen to the conversation I had with Leliana about this exploitative supply chain, slavery in Ansel's supply chain, by heading to 3cr.org.au/Thursday-breakfast. And you can also find all of our previous shows podcasted there. And to hear updates and to keep up to date with the campaign as actions continue to be announced, you can follow Community Defence Marshalling System on Instagram, and that is at communitydefence.cdms. Again, at communitydefence.cdms on Instagram. And yeah, really encourage people to get down and join the fight. You're tuned into Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And if you are just joining us this morning, first up on the show, we were joined by Spike Chapalone, who is an activist, community worker, and co-founder of Homeless Persons Union Victoria. And we spoke about the City of Melbourne Security Force using force against rough sleepers in the city. And then we heard Laniuk and Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira speaking with Mia from 3CR's Earth Matters about the ongoing fight to defend Larrakia country. We'll be back with you shortly on 3CR 855 AM. So stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. We are with you until 8:30 in the morning.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
VCR is about community, and we welcome your participation at the station.
3CR is open to a wide diversity of volunteers and is a great way to connect with Melbourne's activist community.
Have you ever thought about volunteering, doing a reception shift, getting a program on air,
training in radio skills, or contributing to one of the station's committees?
There are many ways to be involved at 3CR.
To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au and get in touch.
And now we are joined by Nicole Bartholomew's Chief Executive at CoHealth, who joins us to discuss their second consecutive Platinum Honour at 2026 Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards. She has been the Chief Executive at CoHealth since 2019, having served as a vital decision maker in a range of leadership roles in community health since 2006. And in this interview, we discuss why CoHealth is so vital. Thanks so much for joining us here, Nicole.
Good morning. It's great to join you.
Could you tell us more about the Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards and the Health and Wellbeing Equality Index it was judged on?
Absolutely. So the Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards are presented each year to recognise and really celebrate incredible efforts of organisations and individuals working to make health and human services safer, more inclusive and affirming for our LGBTQ plus communities right across Australia. The Platinum Award, which we've received, and really thrilled to have received this highest recognition 2 years in a row, recognises the work of our staff at CoHealth and our commitment to ensuring that we're providing inclusive health and wellbeing services to all community. As you asked, the Health and Wellbeing Equality Index is the only benchmarking tool that we have which really enables us to benchmark how we're going to ensure that LGBTQ plus inclusion is in place in our organisation. It supports organisations to really embed the LGBTQ plus inclusive practices and allows services to measure their progress and benchmark their progress against other peers in the sector.
Yeah, amazing. Thank you so much. It's clearly such an honour to win that award, and you know, given how important co-health is, could you tell us more about the importance of co-health within the Victorian healthcare system and why it's unique in that way?
Sure. Co-health is one of 22 independent community health organisations across Victoria, providing health and wellbeing services to communities who ordinarily experience challenges accessing care through mainstream health service providers. We have been providing services to the community for more than 150 years, albeit with different organisational names over that time. And today we're one of Australia's largest not-for-profit community health providers. So what we do is provide low-cost and free local health and wellbeing support services, including medical, oral health, allied health, mental health, aged care, and specialist health services for people who are vulnerable in Melbourne CBD, inner north and inner west, but also most recently on the east coast of Tasmania. So through our work in delivering these health and wellbeing services, we're also aiming to improve the health and wellbeing of the communities that we serve by addressing health and social inequity and really focusing on the social determinants of health, so those factors which really play a large role in people's health and wellbeing, such as access to affordable housing, secure housing, access to education, access to training, all of those factors, environmental factors, really impact an individual's ability to obtain good health and wellbeing.
Yeah, amazing. I think what's so important and what you've just touched on is that it is, you know, the largest, and it is so important with all the wraparound services that you provide. I know it's not just, you know, GP services. Could you talk about some of the other services that are available at CoHealth? I know there's pharmacy and mental health and AOD, but really, yeah, what it means to, yeah, have that wraparound support, and particularly generationally.
Absolutely. So we know that with the communities that we walk alongside, access to these services is vital. And so community health, or what CoHealth does, is actually deliver a model of care that wraps these vital services around the individual. So an individual might walk in, they might have a dental emergency, they might be seeking some pain relief, so they'll come in, they'll see our oral health providers, but through that interaction we can actually build that relationship with the individual, understand what their broader health and wellbeing needs might be, and then link them into the other services that CoHealth delivers. We also deliver a range of really targeted services to people that we know need services the most. So we have an extensive homelessness support program, so working and outreach programs through mental health and alcohol and other drug services. So working on the streets with people that are experiencing these issues, engaging with them, building trust, building rapport, understanding what their health and wellbeing needs are, and then linking them into the services that they need. And it might be services that CoHealth provides, or it could be seeing a podiatrist for issues that they have with their feet, or it might be linking them into a housing worker to support them to find some secure housing. So it's really a wraparound service model, as you've described, and it's really relational. So it's really based on building long relationships with people, understanding what their needs are, and working with them or walking alongside with them to engage in the services that they need.
Yeah, thank you for outlining that. I think it's so important, and what makes CoHealth so vital and unique is that wraparound support, because, you know, in an increasingly privatised healthcare where you can hardly find a bulk billing GP, the alternatives are urgent care and emergency care, which don't really support preventative community care. And, you know, just bringing it back to the award, what does it mean for CoHealth to win this and support so many multiply marginalised clients where the wraparound model works so well?
The awards like this are so important because they ensure that all of us at CoHealth continue to strive for inclusive spaces and experiences for not only clients and community, but also our staff who are part of the LGBTQ plus community. And I think it's really important to acknowledge that this award isn't just about us, but it's about the communities that we serve. But it's also about taking a leadership role as a healthcare provider to demonstrate why inclusive spaces and experiences are important. And I really hope, Inez, that by talking with you this morning, that other organisations who might not be participating in this work hear this interview and reach out and talk to us about the work that we do and why we do it and get on board. Because as a healthcare provider, well, healthcare is a human right, and as a healthcare provider, we have an obligation to deliver care that is inclusive. And so I hope that this encourages other healthcare providers to also get on board with this fantastic benchmarking tool that's provided.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know that you have, you know, so much experience around different leadership positions in community health, but particularly at CoHealth. And yeah, I 100% agree. You're looked at such a leader, and so many other places will follow suit. And I know, you know, looking at the benchmarks and winning this award, just to strip it back, what barriers do LGBTIQA plus people face in accessing healthcare services and employment, yeah, particularly in increasingly privatised healthcare systems?
Yeah, sadly, today, LGBTQI plus people continue to experience really high levels of systemic and interpersonal discrimination when they access health services. And as a result of that, they often delay seeking the care that they need. And this then exacerbates the health conditions or health problems that they have. So by the time they do reach out to a healthcare provider, the conditions that they've been experiencing are actually a lot worse. We know that this disproportionately high rates of ill health and mental health amongst the LGBTQ plus community. Discrimination has been has to be viewed as a health issue, and it must be proactively prevented to create health and wellbeing equity. And that's why this program and our work in this area is so important. And additionally, we also know that there isn't actually enough specialised services for this community, and community need is really high, and the high demand leads to long wait times. And again, you know, when people are feeling comfortable or have found a provider that they're comfortable to see, often they're then faced with a long wait time for an appointment because there aren't really many specialist services available for this community.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to like access and cost, how does CoHealth really benefit the community in terms of, yeah, access and cost?
Yeah, well, we provide either very low cost or free services to communities. So we're an organisation, a not-for-profit charity organisation that is government funded, and so we really utilise those funds to ensure that the services that we provide are either free or low cost. And because we know that this client group doesn't always have the financial ability to pay for services, so by keeping the services either free or very low cost, it really encourages people to be able to access the services and the care that they need. And this is a really important part of the work that we do. It is increasingly difficult to maintain free and low-cost services because, as you would be aware, in the current environment with high cost of living, it's also really high cost of service delivery as well. So it's a constant challenge for us to make the bottom line work.
Yeah, absolutely. And when it comes to, yeah, alongside those challenges and continuing the commitment and how vital CoHealth is, how does CoHealth like really build towards inclusive environments? Because with LGBTIQA plus people, obviously we know it's not just that group. They multiply marginalised through, you know, refugee and housing and AOD and mental health. And yeah, what does building more inclusive environments look like for CoHealth amongst the cost of living service delivery cost.
Yeah, absolutely. Maintaining our commitment to these communities is vital. And, you know, looking for opportunities also to partner with other organisations who also provide critical services. And we know that if we, partner with other organisations, we can actually deliver really vital, high-quality, affordable and accessible wraparound services. So continuing our commitment to the work that we do, remembering that access to healthcare is a human right, and then partnering with other organisations to deliver great services is a really good way of us bringing holistic services to community.
Yeah, amazing. So yeah, what I've heard is like, yeah, so like collaboration with other similar orgs. But yeah, with the challenges that I'm sure are really, really difficult with, as an executive, you would know, like how to manage the service funding cost, amongst the continuation of services.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And I think, you know, just coming back to this award, just, you know, we have a really small team at CoHealth that leads the inclusion work across the organisation. And I just really want to acknowledge the work of that team, because they do fantastic work each year to ensure that this area of our work remains a priority, and that we're continually striving to improve the way we deliver services so that they are accessible and inclusive.
Yeah, amazing. Thanks so much, Nicole. It's really been helpful to figure out, how we can really build towards CoHealth being accessible and supportive, and continues to be such a vital force in the healthcare system. I was wondering how do we stay up to date with the latest CoHealth news? I've also, heard some public sentiments today that some reviews are being released about CoHealth. But yeah, I'm just wondering, how do we stay up to date with what's happening at CoHealth?
Yeah, so you can visit our website, cohealth.org.au, or follow us on Facebook, Instagram or LinkedIn. Those channels will give you news and information about what's happening at CoHealth, but also equally provide information on the services that are available. I think that's really the best way to keep up to date with CoHealth news, and I'm always happy, Inez, to come back and have a chat with you.
Okay, amazing. Well, thank you so much, Nicole, for coming on the show. Really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
And that was Nicole Bartholomews, the Chief Executive at CoHealth, who joined me to discuss the second consecutive Platinum Honour at the 2026 Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards. She's been the Chief Executive at CoHealth since 2019, serving as a vital decision maker in a range of leadership roles. Stating social justice and health equity are the core principles of her decision-making and key drivers of her advocacy priorities, we discussed why CoHealth is so vital in the Victorian health sector for access and cost, and what's next.
Tune in to Stick Together, all about workers' rights and social justice.
8:30 a.m. Wednesday, 7 a.m. Saturday.
Or listen on demand on 3CR's website, 3cr.org.au.
Has Centrelink made a decision you disagree with? Most Centrelink decisions can be appealed up to 3 times. Examples of decisions you can appeal include whether you're eligible for a payment, cancellation or suspension of your payment, how much you get paid, and Centrelink debts. One of the most common Centrelink decisions appealed are Centrelink debts. Centrelink will say you owe a debt if the staff determine you've been paid more than you should have. Debts can occur for a variety of reasons. In some instances, if there's been an administrative error or if you have special circumstances, you may not have to repay that debt. The appeal process is free, but time limits can apply and will affect your entitlement to back payment. Social Security Rights Victoria is a specialist community legal centre providing Victorians free advice to help you understand your Centrelink issues and the appeal processes. You can contact Social Security Rights Victoria on 9481 0355 or online at ssrv.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
Mm-hmm. You might have heard about the Community Radio Plus app, but it's only when you start using it that you'll wonder how you lived without it.
You can listen to us wherever you are, at home, work, driving,
on public transport, gardening, protesting, or even in the bath.
Just search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
And now we are joined by Simon Tran, the Better Buses campaign spokesperson. Join me to discuss the improving the broken bus network in the West. Simon is a young resident of the West who works as a software engineer but spends his spare time advocating for transport justice in the community. Thanks so much, Simon, for joining us here today. Simon, could you talk to us about how the encouragement for the new public transport services for free in all of April have landed for folks in the West?
So I think for that, I'd say that unfortunately, the people in the West, we feel a bit left out. And, you might be thinking, like, how could that be? Public transport is everywhere, and anyone could take public transport if they want to. Before the West, for many in the West, it was never really about a choice between taking public transport and taking the car to work. For many people, there has been only one option available throughout their lives, and that is to rely on their car to get them around. Many areas in the West kind of lack the, you know, necessary reliable public transport services for people to get themselves to their friends, family, and to loved ones, and to get themselves to all the different kinds of work and other commerce and activity that they need to get to. And this is primarily because there are so many areas in the West that just have a lack of public transport. So when you look at different maps of the accessibility of public transport in the West, there are just so many black zones. And this is made up from issues such as buses only coming up, on average, like every 40 minutes. Even at worst, it could be like an hour. Yeah. Many bus routes that end at 8:30 p.m. and many bus routes that don't even run on weekends. And not only do you have these really clear problems, we also have the issue of the routes themselves. Many routes that are, you know, meandering through the suburbs, and they take almost a bit too much of a detour for people to really consider them as like a fast alternative option to driving. So when you have all these elements of the network not being really something that people can rely on to get them from A to B in an accessible, fast manner, people are just left to drive. And when you, even right now, when we have a fuel crisis, when all levels of government are encouraging us to make that swap from driving to using public transport, unfortunately, I believe the case is just that the people who have been using public transport are those that have been having access already.
Yeah.
And the people who currently, you know, do not have access, they still don't have access. And because of that, it does seem that, you know, we would love to all be able to take advantage of the free public transport, but many of us just can't.
Yeah, absolutely. And even when you're talking, I'm thinking about what it is like to, yeah, like catch a bus that only finishes at 8:30 when you have like a really late night shift or you need to take your kids somewhere on a weekend. And when it feels further and further away, you're in the rain, but also your cars cost money, fuel costs money. It's so important that you have highlighted this because it is not the same for everybody. I know, with the Better Buses campaign, what kind of improvements are you seeking for the Melbourne public transit system? And has the Allan government indicated any willingness to make these changes?
Sure. So I guess our plan or our proposal is that, you know, we make the best use of our existing road network and we send a lot of buses down straight lines along our arterial roads to get people from A to B in the fastest way possible. And we would have many of these routes altogether to form a grid layout, which would then create an exponential amount of, you know, different connection points between all these different routes and an exponential amount of potential journeys that people can be taking using the connected grid. And what we like to call this is getting giddy for the gritty.
An amazing name.
Thank you. It sounds simple, but this is in fact a world-class design method that has been implemented in other cities with similar cultures to us, such as like Vancouver, Toronto, and even just across the pond in Auckland. And such a design has been promoted by research done by the University of Melbourne, Infrastructure Victoria, and even the Committee for Melbourne. And, beyond these, different community NGOs, promoting it, it has also been a part of the state government's own, bus plan document from 2021. And on that one, they released this bus plan in 2021, and we've unfortunately not heard too much about it from since then. But that bus plan had so many of the kind of underlying principles that we share in what we see a good bus network to look like. But fortunately for us, and also a bit unfortunately with the outcome, is that we did get a Freedom of Information request for some progress on that bus plan.
Amazing.
And that came out in September 2025. This was, thanks to a Freedom of Information request made by Chung Liu, Western Metropolitan Upper House member. And from that Freedom of Information request, we found that the Department of Transport and Planning had been working on bus reform, and they had been working on it following the same kind of principles that we were asking for. So they had, a whole map saying that they wanted high-frequency bus routes along all the arterial roads in Melbourne. They also had a phased implementation kind of timeline showing that, we could get bus reform happening in a bunch of different metropolitan regions all across Melbourne. And we could do it yearly, year by year. You could have the West done in 1 year, then you have the North done in the next year. So the timeline they had was one that was quite short, honestly. It was kind of like what we would expect as well, where something like this would only take about a year. And in that timeline, the West was actually prioritized, as they had noted that, it was an area that desperately needed more service and was currently underserved. And in addition to this, many of our bus operators, they're operators that operate, internationally, and they have experience with operating this kind of network.
Yep.
So I believe the CEO of Kinetic, which is I'm pretty sure our largest private bus operator in Melbourne or even Australia, he was quoted saying in an article on the AAP, which just to note that we also managed to appear on that article as well. What he said in that article was, what will come out of this very challenging and difficult moment for everyone is that people see the need for a more developed bus network,
yep,
but also one that's getting closer and closer to turn up and go, which is really the holy grail. So he knows exactly what the community needs. He knows exactly what the community wants. And it's just a matter for the government to pick up this task and deliver it for the community.
Yeah, amazing. But the 4-year delay is so hectic. Wanted to know if you could share some reflections just briefly about the West is Best public symposium that Better Bussons ran last month.
Yeah, so we had a symposium last month where we invited all different kinds of community groups to come together and just share our different experiences about taking the bus and experience of how we would like to see it improved, and really highlight the intersectionality between how public transport impacts just, a wider array of issues throughout society. And, so for that one, for that symposium, I guess for a long time, our collective has been touting the intersectionality of transport justice, and that symposium for us was a way to really manifest that as a reality, to bring all these people together and to really show that, there are so many people who can see the value in improving public transport and how it can help with the issue that they care most about. So, for example, we had organizations such as the Renters and Housing Union, Gen West, which tackles gender equality issues in the West.
Yeah.
West Justice, which tackles like youth justice issues, Environment Victoria, which is quite explanatory, among other groups. And so we had some, like, you know, for example, when it comes to something like housing, public transport really enables the construction of more housing, or enables like housing to be, you know, made possible without needing to create a car dependent neighborhood. So you can, you know, start building houses in a certain area. And if you provide public transport to that area, the people in that area are able to live there without needing to be dependent on the car. And that, you know, just enables that housing to be built as well.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, women's equity issues, there is a key point of like safety when taking the bus.
Absolutely.
And the more people who end up taking the bus, which is kind of what we're trying to do, we want to move us to move beyond just public transport being treated as something that is almost like akin to welfare. And we want people to be seeing the bus as like, you know, a tier one transport option that people can just take when it's possible for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, Simon, we are just running out of time. I could talk to you for so long about this, but, you know, I really wanted to, yeah, just quickly talk about the state budget and elections are coming up this year. What would you like people to know about the campaign and just what you're pushing for? Yeah, just really quickly.
Yeah, so I've spoken already on our proposal, and yeah, we're just trying to make that the big issue at the center of all the different parties, make them on board and make them commit to implementing it. So yeah, please check us out at our website at melbournefoe.org.au/transport. You'll find all the details of our campaign, along with a petition to call on the Victorian government to implement bus reform. And check out our Instagram at better_buses. Where you can find all you need to know about getting giddy for the goody.
Amazing name. And thanks so much, Simon. We will keep all of that in our show notes. But thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye. And that was Simon Tran, Better Buses campaign spokesperson, who joined me to discuss improving the broken bus network in the West. Simon is a young resident and a software engineer and really advocates for transport justice.
And that is all we've got time for on today's show on Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. Just a quick wrap up of what we have covered today. First up, we heard from Spike Chapalone from Homeless Persons Union of Victoria about the ages revelations of the City of Melbourne security force being encouraged to use force against people sleeping rough in the CBD. And we will have a link to their petition ending to end that program in our show notes. And we also listened to part of conversation between Mia from 3CR's Earth Matters and Te Raukura O'Connell Rapira and Laniuk about defending Larrakia country. We also had a brief update from Leliana of the Community Defence Marshalling System about the ongoing fight for justice by former Medisaram workers. And
We joined by Nicole Bartholomew, the Chief Executive of CoHealth, about their 2026 Pride in Health and Wellbeing Awards and what's next for CoHealth. And then Simon Tran, Better Buses campaign, about how to improve the broken bus network in the West and transport justice.
Amazing. And yes, that is all we have time for today on Thursday Breakfast. Thanks again for joining us. And stay tuned for Lost in Science. We'll catch you next week. Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.